Hi everybody, this is John Mulrud. In today's chapter, chapter 8 of Shmuel Bet, we read something of a fitting follow-up to Thursday's chapter, and in some ways not so fitting. David goes on a series of successful conquests against the surrounding kingdoms. First the Philistines, then the Moabites. King David appears to put two-thirds of the Moabites to death. Rashi and other commentators say this is revenge for the death of King David's parents. King David then defeats Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, who is on his way to, translating literally here, Le'ashiv yado ba'na'ar parat, put his hand in the Euphrates River, a demonstration of strength. Aram assists their ally, Hadadezer, so they then too are defeated, and they become a tributary to David. We read Hashem was with David wherever he went. We then read about the gold that was taken from Hadadezer. In case you're interested in the international politics of ancient Mesopotamia, King Toi of Hormat is thrilled at the defeat of his rival Hadadezer. So he sends his son to King David to bless him and to request peace. We'll read later that at the inauguration of the first temple, Hormat is cited as the northern border of Israel, a mountaintop city in Syria, today known as Hama, with a population of 850,000 people. King Toi's son, Yoram, brings silver, gold, and copper. Gam otam akdish hamelech David. David dedicated all of these items that had been collected from the various conquests for what the commentators say will be the future temple. Which is something I'd be curious to hear people's thoughts on. Are we comfortable with the Beit HaMikdash being built from the spoils of war? But anyhow, we read, וימלוך דוד על כל ישראל, ויהי דוד עושה משפט וצדקה לכל עמו. David reigned over all Israel, and David executed justice and righteousness among his people. Really, an ideal king. Towards the end, we learn the names of King David's executive cabinet, so to speak. His general, his sofer, the Kohanim. Oddly, David's sons are also named as Kohanim, despite being part of the tribe of Yehuda. Though the commentators explain this to mean that they simply had positions of significance. In this chapter, combined with last Thursday's chapter, when David asks Natan that he be allowed to build a house for Hashem, we see a period in David's reign where he's a tzaddik. He could really do no wrong. The commentators take this a step further. Rashi explains that in a commentary to the 15th Pasuk, the general Yoav was successful in his battles because David governed with justice and righteousness. And in return, David was able to govern with righteousness because Yoav fought these battles. Furthermore, since Yoav was involved with the fighting, David didn't have to be, and instead could be focused on being a righteous ruler. This commentary was peculiar for a couple of reasons. First, maybe David was no longer the shepherd that took down Goliath with his slingshot, or the lieutenant to Shaul who slayed tens of thousands of men. He was likely more occupied with the politics of his role. But nonetheless, the chapters that follow, and reading many of the Tehillim, will show that David was involved in the military for a large part of his reign, and it's hard for David to be sanitized of that. But then the second part of Rashi's commentary, I think, reflects a view that has seeped into the political discussion in modern Israel, that the realm of holiness and of Torah study are separate from the supposedly secular work of fighting for and defending a country. Rashi obviously didn't live at a time where there was a Jewish army, so he likely wasn't thinking in these terms. But there's certainly a debate alive today in Israel among the religious that those who engage in Torah study should be exempt from the military. In fact, one could say that it's the reason that Israel's having elections in September. While it's a political topic that's probably too complicated to discuss at length here, I will say that the Perek does hint on another matter relating to Israel's national defense. It relates to a topic that Rav Joe discusses in Shmuel Aleph, when he cited Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's letter to Menachem Begin, about the problematic nature of fighting a battle for reasons other than your own self-defense. With that in mind, we can look at each of today's conquests and see David defeats the Philistines who had just defeated Shaul and his sons. David defeats the Moabites who had just killed David's family. He defeats Hadadezer, king of Zobah, who appears to have been something of an imperialist. And then he defeats Aram, who assisted the king of Zobah. It seems each of David's battles have a justification, and the text shows that David HaMelech is rewarded for this. The battle against Edom seems to fall less in line with the others, and even David HaMelech treats them differently when, according to the Mefarshim, he takes the time to bury the corpses of each of the enemy combatants. Edom, we may remember, are Israel's cousins, descended from Esav. Esav, who was promised by Yaakov in his blessing, that when his brother Yaakov's yoke becomes too much, Esav, who is promised by Yitzchak in his blessing, that when his brother Yaakov's yoke becomes too much for Esav's descendants to bear, they'll eventually throw it off and rise up against Israel. The relationship with Edom will come up again, and it should continue to be a source of discussion as we progress through 9-9. Shavua Tov, everyone.